DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
I'm just popping down to the corner shop.
Can you get some milk and take the dog with you?
The Corner Shop, where ordinary folk tell stories of anecdotes, folklore and legend.
I'm delighted to be joined by a wonderful lady, Sheila McMillan, who's come to the museum today. Sheila, you've got quite a story to tell.
Well, I think so. It's not a story about Darfield directly, but it's about a story about someone who had a very strong connection, and his family did, and I still live in Darfield, and I just want his story to be told.
Now, who are we talking about? It's your grandfather, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a granddad that I didn't know because he died before I was born. And in fact, it was a dad that the children hardly knew, you know, my mum and her siblings, because of what happened to him after the war. So his name's George Bradley. He was born in a little village just 2 miles or so from where we are today in the museum at Broomhill. And he was born into quite a large family and in a very tiny house. And he seems to have been very active in all kinds of ways. He was active in the chapel. He was active in the football teams, the cricket teams. And he was also sometimes a bit active when he shouldn't have been. I was looking when I was doing some research in old newspaper articles, and I found that in October, I think it's 1907, when George would have been 13, he was in trouble with the local police, along with his mates, because they'd been doing the terrible thing of setting fireworks off in the street. And I quite like that, because it makes him into a lad.
Yeah, well, obviously, as he got older, I think he went down the pit, and he was quite a productive miner, by all accounts.
Yeah, he was very productive. Many, many years ago, when we were doing some clearing out upstairs, my mum and I were emptying probably a blanket box or something, and there was this frame photograph, and it's a frame photograph I'd never seen before, of this really handsome, and I mean handsome, young man dressed in the uniform of the Yorks and Lancs, got thick black hair, good looking chap. But what really impressed me were his hands. His hands, they were clenched on his knees, but they were so strong. They were amazing hands. Anyway, I said to my mum, can I have this photograph? And she couldn't say no, could she really? So I'm really glad I was a bit forward in asking for something. And we used to have a chap come to our house who'd also served in the Yorks and Lancs, like George obviously did. And he told me that when George worked at the pit, he had a nickname. And because he was such a strong worker, his name was Bull Bradley. Now, at the pit, if they did a really good production week, it was called a Bull Week. So he was obviously a very productive worker.
Now, obviously, and that time, the start of the century, First World War came along. Unfortunately, many men didn't come home from that war. Thankfully, your grandfather did. How was he when he got back?
He apparently joined up not immediately at the start of the war. He joined up, it looks like, October 1915, along with a chum of his who lived just a couple of houses away from them in Broomhill. So they joined up and were posted to France, and then I've never really able to find anything specific, but I did come across one particular newspaper report about how they joined up as chums, it says, at the beginning of the war, and then they'd moved from the Yorks and Lancs into the Royal Engineers. And within the Royal Engineers, they formed a special brigade that, well, it was a really unpleasant set of tasks that they had. It was dealing with the gas and with the flamethrowers. And as they were setting up some, what they call a stunt, one night with a few others, a shell landed in their midst, killing two of them and wounding, amongst others, my grandfather. So he was in the thick of the action. And he came out in 1919 and he came home. So everything seemed to be okay. Now, sadly, when he went home, he found that his sister, who was next to him in the line of children, she wasn't there anymore. And the reason for that was she'd died of the Spanish flu and left two little children who'd now been brought into the house. So there were quite a lot of them in that house. Anyway, being a young man, he used to be on the lookout for a nice young lady. And up in Wunwall, which is not far from here, there was a stretch of the road known as the Bunny Run. And it was the bit, it was the bit of the road where lads and lasses could meet up unchaperoned and probably walk up and down and all the rest of it. Anyway, while he was there, he met a young woman and she worked at the house of Dr. Blackburn, the doctor of Barnsley. She was a domestic servant, and they fell in love. And she would talk in her old age, because she lived to be 97, how in the right time of year, obviously, when they were meeting up, as he approached her, he'd lift his hat and bring out a flower. So obviously they were very, very much in love. So they got married and then they had a family. But then as I looked more into the newspaper reports, I found that it wasn't working. On the open main book, when they're writing up the wages and that, his name's there, but no record of him having worked. And that was in the mid-20s. And then there would have been a fundraising concert to help the family in December 1927. So his illness, which seems eventually to have been diagnosed as severe shell shock, was obviously really impacting their lives. By this time, they got a little house down on what we call the Dyke Side, down the Darfield Bridge. So they've got a downstairs room, a teeny weeny kitchen, a bedroom and an attic. And the severe shell shock symptoms must have affected those little girls. They couldn't have got away from it.
It's amazing, isn't it, that it took 9 years for those horrible things that he must have seen in the war to sort of bubble to the surface. But he must have been living with that from the day he left the army.
Yeah, they wouldn't have recognised it at first. And I think the very fact he was back down the pit would be an environment that would often precipitate and bring these memories to the fore. And I can't imagine, someone once said that they used to see him like at the side of the house, but just trembling and incapacitated.
Well, in 1928, he was hospitalised to quite a famous building, I believe, the Star and Garter, which was turned into a convalescent home, I suppose is the best way you could call it. And he spent the rest of his life there. Now, this is based down in Richmond in Surrey. How did that come about?
Well, the local doctor, Dr. Castle, had himself been an ace flyer of types in the early Royal Air Force. And he'd been shot down and he'd been a prisoner of the Germans himself for 16 months. And I think that gave him a particular affinity and a concern for George. I really do. I think he was a very good doctor when you read about what he did generally. And so he got also London origins and no doubt connections. And I think it was through Dr. Castle, because when my mum used to go down there, which was very infrequently, she used to say, we always used to go and see Dr. Castle's mother. And she always used to give my mother this amazing gift of 2 shillings, a florin. And that was big money. Yeah. Because they were living hand to mouth. There weren't the benefits. There was nothing like that. It was a case of applying for parish relief and taking washing in and getting by.
George's family must have struggled while he was in hospital. Because obviously, I suppose in those days, the man was the breadwinner for the family, weren't they?
Yeah, I can't imagine it. I mean, I heard various things from my mum. Odd times she'd say things, like the time when there was a delivery of sort of charity shoes to the school and she was given some and had to wear these shoes. And our people sometimes would be nasty, girls would, and say, you ain't got a dad, you. And she had got a dad and she wished she'd got a dad.
1944, George passed away. So he spent a considerable amount of time in the convalescent home, and his funeral was back in Darfield, I believe, just at the height of the Blitz, I suppose.
Well, it's the V1s that were being dropped on London in July, late June and July 44. Richmond itself had been bombed. So that, I think, would have precipitated. On his death certificate, it says heart attack, but obviously it's the shell shock. They call it neurasthenia and severe general debility. In fact, when they used to visit him, they were only allowed to take him out in a bath chair and take him across. I mean, it was a wonderful situation, looking down onto the Thames and Richmond Park. So they could take him out and have some family time. And what I love and makes him so human again is my mum used to say, they always took him his favourite sweets. And actually, they're one of my favourite sweets, licorice allsorts. And whenever I have a licorice allsort, I always think about my granddad. You know, I really do. Yeah, so he came back for burial and that was held up for a day because of the damage in the capital. But he came home and a few years ago, my mum, when she was in her 90s, paid for a new stone It's just minutes from our house. And so it's good I can tend his grave and have a word with him sometimes and tell him he's got a book about him.
Well, such an important story that, as you say, you have written a little book about your experiences and George's own experiences, I suppose. Where can people find this book?
At the moment, it's on sale in Darfield in the museum, which in itself is really worth a visit if you've never been. Lovely cake, coffee and company. It's on sale as well, just up from the museum in the library and also in the card shop a little bit higher up the road. So, and if you have any problem getting it, leave your name and details at the museum or library and I'll see what I can do. And every penny is going to the Poppy Appeal because they were the ones who paid for the travel so they could go down to see the dad.
Sheila, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today.
Good morning, my name is Pauline Markham. I'm the local councillor for Darfield. I'm just letting you know that the Maurice Dobson Museum has been nominated for a Pride of Barnsley Award. It was nominated by Councillor Kevin Osborne, but supported by Councillor Smith and myself. The reason we didn't nominate it was because we're trustees on the board and we didn't want to be nominating ourselves for a prize. I was the Mayor of Barnsley from 2019 and did 18 months as the Mayor, at which time I had the people from the museum into the Mayor's parlour for afternoon tea, which they all enjoyed, and we all had a really good afternoon and a good laugh. Stories were told, which I will not repeat on this podcast. But they were very nice, and it were a very good afternoon. Maurice Dobson has been an integral part of this village for years and years, and it was donated in the will by Maurice Dobson for Barnsley Council. That's why Barnsley councillors are on the board of trustees, because it were half left to us. We let the museum run itself, but we look after the buildings. So anything that happens to the buildings, we have to repair and keep going. And as one of the trustees, we're just in the process of getting something done with the roof. But I come here every Saturday, and you'll find some characters in here that's always good for a laugh. You've got Stephen and you've got Marlene and usually Margaret Venables and her husband, who are part of the church community as well. We all sit, we all have a laugh. Yeah, I came in 1 week, no money. Yes, I know what you're saying. No money, they're all chestnut. But I didn't have to worry because they were all queuing up to buy me coffees. I ate quite enough, thank you. But I says, they asked me why I was late, and I says, well, I've been around all cash machines to try to get some money, because this is the only place that I have to use cash, because I've not got a cash machine. And everybody laughed. Oh, yes, they're all chestnuts. All right, Pauline, we'll buy you typical councillor. I'll buy you a coffee. And we'll get Evie a Coke as well, because my granddaughter Evie always comes into the museum with me on a Saturday morning. She enjoys the chat and everything that goes round with us. And I often give Marlene a lift home, don't I, Marlene? We have a good time. It is really a friendly atmosphere in here. Everybody's friendly. Everybody's got a laugh. We've got the local artist in this morning who does fantastic pictures that we've got displaying round here. It's one of the trustees or one of the helpers, I'm not sure which, is Ian McMillan. And he's here helping do teas and coffees on a regular basis. Ian, I will also say, also does everything for Darfield. If you ask him to do something and he's available, he will do it, and he will do it free of charge. So, you know, we're not all tight in Darfield, no matter what people are saying.
My name is William Platts, known as Bill. I'm a retired civil engineer, and I went to work for Loss Adjusters because I was an engineer. And they hadn't had a civil engineer before, but so I went to see this house in Knaresborough. And when I got there, I went into the house.
Yeah.
When you enter a hall, rooms on the left and rooms on the right. So I was invited to come in, and so I said, I need to go into every room in this house. It's three stories. And I was gasping for air. I said, what do you call this room? She says, I call it the cat litter room. And it was three inch deep cat litter. So anyway, that was one experience. So then, and so we went into every room, and whilst I was making notes of all the different rooms and whatnot, so I kept thinking to the woman kept getting lost, and so the woman of the house was sat on a poofy, and I realised straight away why she'd been suddenly disappearing. She was an alcoholic.
Okay.
She was blind drunk, see. So I then twigged why her husband wasn't there, and the representative on her sure insurance company were there. And so I said, I better be at my retreat, because I had visions of me appearing in the News of the World, you know. The one, the negligee one, was in Harrogate. And when I went there, I had to ring her up because she was still in bed. She came to the door, dressed in a negligee, and I thought, goodness gracious me. So I deal with the case. She wanted to make an insurance claim, but she'd no money. Her husband had left her. He'd gone off to the continent somewhere. And so she gave us a cup of tea, and we just sat there talking, still dressed in a negligee. And that was just one incident of being a loss of use. As a boy, as a youth, we lived in Low Valley, in a street that now no longer exists, as far as I know, James Street, number 4 James Street. We lived there in this thing, and my mother, she was a widow at this time. I never knew my father, but she must have had an affair, because I got a brother as well, so I don't know where he came from. He's dead now, sadly, poor lad, she used to make ends meet. And the problem was she was a bag of nerves. She could clap her hands and she would faint. And she was told by the doctor, if she didn't get a job, go do homework somewhere, she would die. So anyway, one of the things that we used to do, she used to do sewing. She could sew anything. And, well, she could practically do anything anyway. But so she's showing. And I used to sit on the windowsill and treadle the sewing machine while she sewed. And then if she had a wedding, I used to model all the dressmates as a boy.
How many dresses have you worn?
Oh, a lot. I don't know. It went on years, that. My dad and her used to have a fish and chip shop. And the way she got married to my father was, he was a patient in Rotherham Hospital. And one night day she went in to see this patient, William Platts. And she was crying. So he said, what's the matter with thee, Smithy? She said, well, eventually she said, my boyfriend's just jilted me, and it's upset me. And so my dad said to her, he said, if that gets me out of this bed, I'll marry thee. And he did. So... We that's how we started life. While the miners' strike was on, by this time, 1984, you probably remember that, I was actually made redundant with the consulting engineers that I was working for. It's not a very good experience being made redundant. It happened to me a couple of times, but this first time, I took on a job to work for Barnsley Borough Council, and I used to have to crawl live sewers in a wetsuit. Yes, the thing, and we also were laying drains as well across fields. You pass them on the way to Thurnscourt, the fields as they're on the right hand side, but that was another experience. I was to travel drains in a wetsuit, and you and then get cleaned up afterwards, and that lasted for about 15 months to say 18 months.
I'm Maureen Sega Francis, and I was born in Darfield, but now I live in Wombwell, but I've moved around quite a lot in between then and now. I went to the Shrugs Head School when my mum and I moved to Darfield, when my mum got married again for the second time, because the first time my father was killed in the war. And I was 7 when we moved back to Darfield. I've got very good memories of Wombwell, but of course, when you're 7, you remember things a lot better. Shrugs Head was a beautiful school. It was modern, well-designed, airy. I really enjoyed being there. When we moved to the primary school, it's a very old school. I don't know when it was built. It must have been sometime at the end of the 19th century, I should think. And it's a spire. It's got a spire, huge classrooms with high ceilings and a fireplace. And we used to have monthly tests. And these were to encourage us to pass the 11 plus. Everything that we'd learnt that month would be tested. We'd all have to get up at the end of the test, stand in the corner, and then we would be placed in order of precedence according to how well we'd done. All the bright kids sat down where the pipes were, so they were nice and warm. The ones who didn't do so well were at the other end of the classroom. The teacher used to have a plinth, I would call it, or a lectern, and looked down on us all, and we sat obediently at our desks, two together. As it was just after the war, we didn't have many books. We always had to share them, and they were a bit tatty. And I do think now how lovely it would have been to have nice coloured books. On a Friday afternoon, we were allowed to have painting, and we were given... We had monitors who brought the paints round. We had a glass of water and a brush and some very thin paper. It was very difficult to make anything decent on that thin paper, but we all had a go at it. And it'd always be a mess. Somebody'd always knock over their water and somebody'd always splash paint all over the place. The headmaster had his office. Well, you couldn't call it an office. It's his desk in, I think it was class 3. So he was sitting at the side while all the kids were being taught. It must have been very difficult for him, and also very difficult, I think, for the teacher who was teaching at that time. Mrs. Taylor was my first teacher in Standard 1, and she was a large lady. We used to have to spend, I think, about 20 minutes at the beginning of each day learning the catechism. We learnt it off by heart. I'm not going to try to quote it now, because
I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to either.
Well, I can remember quite a bit of it, but not right now. And they used to explain it to us, but I don't think many of the kids really understood what it was all about, because it is in sort of like ancient, well, Elizabethan English, isn't it? Yeah, you know. Anyway, we had this learning the catechism, and I used to enjoy it because there is a kind of a rhythm and a music to that English, and I used to quite enjoy it. And then we used to go in, the girls were split up from the boys. The girls went to knitting classes with Mrs. Adams, who was my favourite teacher because she was always so glamorous looking. You couldn't really identify yourself with the other teachers. she taught us how to knit, and that was fun. And the boys used to go out into the garden. There was a kind of a big garden, and they used to go out digging, and we used to laugh about them going out digging, because I don't think it was a very popular thing to do at the time. Although it was just after the war, and I think a lot of people did have allotments, but it wasn't seen as a masculine thing to do, really. It was... I don't know why, but it wasn't.
So what was life like for a teenage girl growing up in Darfield?
It was depressing. I used to have nice clothes. My mother always, we weren't very, very well off. Dad worked down the mine. She used to make all my clothes. She even used to knit my socks for me. And I used to hate it, going to grammar school with thick socks when everybody else had got nice, thin socks from the shops. Mine were better, but I didn't realise it at the time. And as a teenager, well, I used to go to the cinema quite a lot. I used to go to the cinema in Darfield and sometimes with friends or family to Barnsley. Once a year, the family would go to a pantomime, and occasionally my mother would take me to the amateur dramatics, which was held at the old Folston School. And that was about it when it came to any kind of society. And I used to go to the church a lot because I wanted to go to a teacher training college, and you had to build up a bit of a CV. And so I used to go to church. Well, I went originally because my grandmother was very religious and we all had to go. And I actually was a member of the choir, but I was only a member of the choir because my grandmother was very influential and I couldn't sing.
I was going to say, could you sing?
No, I couldn't sing. But I used to enjoy putting the clothes on and walking around the church. And especially at night time, it was very ethereal and it had got atmosphere, lovely atmosphere in that church. I loved the church. Now, back to a teenager. I think I was a bit skinny and I don't think I was very attractive because I never seemed to attract boys.
Maybe they were scared of you.
You were scared of me. No, I don't. Yeah, perhaps they were, because I was always very independent. I'd been brought up without a father and I'd had to do things for myself. And my mother used to put me on the bus at Womwell, and I used to get off at Darfield and walk up to my grandmother's at the top of Barnsley Road by myself when I was only 6 years old, maybe even younger than that. So I've always had to be independent, yeah. And as I say, I wanted to go to college. I didn't particularly want to be a teacher, but there wasn't much to choose. There weren't jobs to choose from in those days. I went to Barnsley High School, and I wasn't particularly happy there, but I struggled because once I got to the second year, my parents couldn't help me anymore, education-wise. Well, I think that other kids were getting a bit of help one way or another. But that's what happens when you come from I wouldn't say it was deprived, but it wasn't particularly thriving as a community, really. And it was very insular, and I didn't like that. I didn't like the twitching curtains and mother not being able to do a washing on a Sunday if she wanted to. You know, they had all these little regulations that people stuck to, and I wasn't happy with them. I was questioning them, I think. So I really wanted to get away from Darfield. I found it very constricting, yeah. But other people were quite happy here. Made their lives here, were successful. They didn't all have to go away. But I did.
Tune in again for the next episode of The Corner Shop.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.